If you're like me, then you never tire of a classic whodunit. Well, I have the perfect game for you, June's Journey. This is a free-to-download mobile game, and the objective is to find objects that are hidden within beautiful, colourful, and carefully crafted scenes. June's Journey is set in the 1920s and has a really glamorous aesthetic, as well as a diverse cast of characters. You get to play as June Parker, an amateur detective investigating a series of mysteries. Each scene in the game takes you through a murder mystery, but along the way you'll find yourself uncovering a number of secrets, with lots of twists and turns around every corner. What I love especially about this game is that it's super relaxing and therapeutic, but at the same time it really tests your observations and keeps your mind fresh. I even find myself playing this game as I'm cooking dinner. Ready to awaken your inner detective? Download June's Journey for free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Like most of you, I'm hoping that things will get back to normal soon, and we can hang out with our friends, go to the bar, and even travel. If you're wanting to keep yourself preoccupied while we wait for some normalcy, download Best Fiends. It's been keeping me preoccupied during the past while, and it's a great game filled with cute characters, which is a refreshing break from true crime writing. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. There's thousands of levels and tons of characters. I'm on level 291, but there's new puzzles to solve each and every day. It's one of those games where 30 minutes really feels like 30 seconds. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and it's fun to play. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I need a break while writing. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. Mount Vernon is a town located in New Hampshire, in the United States. It's the home of around 2,500 residents, and consists almost entirely of single-family homes and just a handful of stores. It has a real quaint feel to it, and is considered by many to be the perfect location to raise a family, free from the violence that can plague bigger towns and cities. In October of 2009, however, this quaint town would be rocked by an extremely brutal murder. A murder that became a chilling reminder to the world that you're never truly safe, even in your own home. It was around 4:20 a.m. on the 4th of October 2009. When police in Mount Vernon, New Hampshire, received a call from a young girl who exclaimed that somebody had entered her home and attacked her and her mother with sharp weapons. They were directed to a home on Trow Road, which was a half-mile long dirt road with four homes dotted along the road. It was located on the outskirts of town and was a relatively secluded area. The home was owned by 42-year-old nurse Kimberly Cates and her husband David, and they lived there with their 11-year-old daughter Jamie. It was Jamie who had placed the 911 call. Police Sergeant Kevin Furlong was the first officer to arrive at the home. He had one mission on his mind, to rescue the little girl and get her out of the house as quickly as possible. He wasn't sure if the attacker or attackers were still inside the home or not. He broke down a door and came across an extremely horrific scene. There was blood spattered across the walls and on the floor. He found Jamie. He grabbed her and rushed her out of the house immediately. As she said, "They killed my mommy." Jamie was suffering from stab wounds to the head, throat and foot. Conscious, but of course in a great deal of pain and shock. During the attack, Jamie's toes had been chopped off. Jamie would be flown to Children's Hospital in Boston by helicopter, while the responding officers proceeded to enter the family home. Inside Kimberly and David's master bedroom, they found the lifeless body of Kimberly on the bed. She had been brutally attacked with a machete. Kimberly had sustained serious injuries to her head, torso, arms and legs. She had also sustained stab wounds. Kimberly was pronounced dead at the scene. At the time, David had been away on a business trip, and it was only Kimberly and Jamie inside the home. The crime scene at the home had been so gruesome that the responding emergency personnel had to meet with mental health workers. Mark Hastings, the hospital's EMA trauma coordinator, said, "The safest statement we could make on behalf of the people that responded is that it was a horrible event." Police would announce that they were searching for two men in connection with the attack. One man was described by Jamie as a tall, skinny, bald man wearing a blue hooded sweatshirt, while the second man was only described as being shorter than the first. The murder and attempted murder completely stunned the area, and fear swept across the community. The notion that two men could slip into somebody's home in the middle of the night and unleash such a senseless attack was absolutely terrifying. Senior Assistant Attorney General William Delker said, "At this point, we don't know whether the killing is random or specific. Mount Vernon was known to be a very safe area, where everybody knew their neighbours and looked out for one another. It was only the second violent crime recorded in Mount Vernon in the past 10 years. Deputy House Speaker Linda Foster, who had lived in the town for 40 years, referred to it as a picture-perfect town, and the grisly attack was terrifying for the community. There was an immediate fear that whoever committed the attack could very easily attack again, and since it was a random attack, anybody could be the next victim. They would be left with a heightened sense of awareness, and many would be double-checking their doors were locked at night. The town, however, wouldn't have long to wait before somebody was arrested in connection with the gruesome murder and attempted murder. Just the following day, four teenagers would be arrested. 17-year-old Stephen Spader and 19-year-old Christopher Gribble, both of Brookline, were arrested and charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and attempted murder, and they were ordered to be held without bail. 18-year-old William Marks, also known as Billy, and 17-year-old Quinn Glover were charged with burglary, conspiracy to commit burglary, and robbery, and were ordered to be held on $500,000 cash bail. According to prosecutors, the four teenagers had driven to the secluded neighbourhood with the intent of breaking into a home, robbing it, and murdering the occupants of the home. They had chosen the Cates home at random, but they didn't know who the home belonged to or who would be in the home at the time. The plan was simply to kill whoever was inside the home, and their home was chosen in particular because it was isolated. Senior Assistant General Delker said, "All four of these defendants were aware before they entered the home that the intent was to kill the occupants inside. All four teenagers had come armed with weapons, but only two of those teenagers would use those weapons. Upon entering the home, they crept into Kimberly's bedroom, where Stephen began slashing and stabbing at her with a machete, whilst Christopher stabbed her with a knife. Kimberly, who stood at barely 5 foot, didn't have a chance to defend herself. They then turned their attention to Jamie, who was sleeping in the same bed as her mother, and left her for dead. The Cates family had moved into the Blue Ranch-style home on Truro Road in May of 2005. You can see photographs of the home on the Vodacast app. They'd come to Mount Vernon from Owings Mill, Maryland. They were a welcome addition to the sleepy hamlet, and the one-story home was just perfect for the family. It was modern and secluded, and located on a very picturesque tree-lined road. It was surrounded in woodland, and had a stone wall along the road frontage. Kimberly was a registered nurse and worked part-time in area hospitals, while her husband David worked as a principal systems engineer at BAE Systems. The family were known to be friendly and good neighbours. As Mary Minami said, they were so good and kind and always said hello. Kimberly could often be spotted jogging in the neighbourhood and she was very health conscious. Her friends often used to tease her for her devotion to healthy food. Kimberly was a devoted mother and wife, and as her friend John Quinion said, she was very much the extrovert. The mother and daughter were inseparable. They were almost best friends as well. Jamie was a sixth grader at the village school, and she had just recently taken up kayaking with her mother. Jamie was very outdoorsy and never liked to be sitting in on the couch. She loved playing basketball, soccer, and tag with her friends, and was very outgoing. You can see photographs of the Cates family on the Vodacast app. In the immediate aftermath of the murder and attempted murder, David flew back home so that he could be with his daughter. Her injuries were so severe that she needed to undergo hours of surgery. Following the surgery, she was taken into intensive care and reported to be in stable condition. Senior Assistant General Delker said, "Her injuries are very serious. I know her recovery will be very long. I don't know if it will be complete." As news of the arrest swept throughout the area, many would be left wondering what kind of person could attack an innocent mother and a defenseless child for seemingly no reason other than because they wanted to. According to those who knew Christopher, his mood and behaviour had become darker as he entered sophomore year. One friend, who wished to be anonymous, said that he was in and out of treatment plans and often took marijuana and speed. He said that he often spoke about suicide, adding that he thought it was more likely he would one day kill himself than somebody else. He had been adopted into a very loving family, and his grandmother Mary Spader said, "They did everything for him, gave him everything. They were devoted to this kid." Christopher was an avid Facebook user. He had filled out a survey titled, 25 Random Things About Me, in which he said he liked swords, knives and daggers. He had also written, "Although everyone has a light and dark side, mine are very extreme. If I like you, or at least don't dislike you, I'm the sweetest, nicest person ever. But heaven help you if I truly lose it. It's not pretty." He had also posted, "I'm a gentleman to a fault. I would never ever hit a girl. And I do that whole open doors ladies first thing, no matter if hardly anyone appreciates it anymore." It was ironic coming from somebody who was now accused of murdering a woman and attempting to murder a little girl. Christopher had come from a Mormon family and was homeschooled. According to a friend, he had struggled with his own demons and absolutely despised his father. He had even spoken about wanting to kill him in the past. James Mark, William's father, would tell the union leader that just hours before the murders occurred, Stephen flicked open a knife with a 4-inch blade in front of him. He said he advised Stephen to get rid of the knife because he thought it was illegal and could end up getting him into trouble. He said that the four teenagers were at his home and left at around 11 p.m. because his son had to take his girlfriend back to her home in Milford. The trip should have taken around 10 minutes, but when his son didn't return, he tried to call him and repeatedly text him, but heard nothing back until around 4 a.m. when he picked up and said that he was coming home. When William came home, he went into his bedroom and said nothing, which could have indicated he was just involved in a very grisly murder. Just hours after the murders were committed, Stephen and Christopher went to the Pheasant Lane Mall to sell jewellery which they had stolen from the Cates home, including necklaces and chains. The clerk at the store, which pays cash for gold, said to the New Hampshire union leader, "They just came in with smiles on their faces," and said, We got this gold at a yard sale. Christopher had used his name and address to process the sale because Stephen was underage. Around 700 people would descend on the village of Mount Vernon the day after the arrest to honour the Cates family at a candlelight vigil. They paid tribute to Kimberly and they prayed for Jamie. Just after 6 p.m, they left the village school and silently walked with candles in hand to the local fire station. Once here, they listened as three speakers comforted them, gave them hope and reminded them of the importance of community. Paul Apple asked those in attendance to stop and consider the anger and fear they were feeling and to seek forgiveness. He said, "Anger and fear are only a beginning, a place of transition to something else." St. Joseph's Hospital, where Kimberly had worked, and the Mount Vernon Neighbour to Neighbour Fund would set up two donation funds to help raise money for the Cates family. The Neighbour to Neighbour Fund had been set up to allow residents within Mount Vernon to reach out to their fellow residents in need. The candlelight vigil alone, they had raised over $2,000 for the family. The community really rallied around the family at their time of need. There were going to be hospital bills, expenses for David travelling to and from the hospital, and then, of course, funeral expenses. 4 days after the attack, Jamie was able to move out of intensive care, and some of her friends were allowed to visit her in the hospital. A few days later, a private ceremony was held at the Mount Vernon Congregational Church for Kimberly. Jamie attended the service in a wheelchair. Around 200 people would attend the 90-minute service. Finally, on the 20th of October, 2 weeks after the attack, Jamie would return home with her father. A family friend would say, "She's just amazing. I can't say that enough. And you just feel it from her, her strength. She's amazing." On the Thursday, she went back to school for a quick visit with her classmates. Superintendent Mary Jennings said that she would be transitioning back to school on Monday. She would attend part of the classes at school and then receive tutoring at home for the rest of the day. Before returning to school, school officials read a statement to pupils from Jamie and her father, which read, "Jamie and her dad, David, want to thank all of her friends, teachers and classmates for their support. The cards, DVDs, posters and gifts have made the hospital stay and the return home much nicer. Jamie is returning to school today and she wants you to know that she's getting better every day. Soon, she will be 100%, but right now she's in a wheelchair and her foot and arm are healing. Her foot is in a cast and she can't stand on it. Her arm is in a brace and her cuts are healing. Therefore, we need to be very careful around her arm and her foot. Jamie and her dad request that we don't ask her a lot of questions about what happened. Jamie will talk with her friends and classmates as she feels comfortable. Jamie and her dad want you to know that they are very proud she goes to Mount Vernon Village School and are glad to be back at home with friends." In early November, Republican Representative William O'Brien announced that he was sponsoring legislation to make home invasion killings a capital offence, adding that he was wanting to name the bill after Kimberly. He essentially said that your home should be a safe haven, and the bill would send the message to protect the sanctity of the home. He stated, "We all go to bed to sleep and have the right to expect that we won't wake up with a murderer standing over us with a machete. That's among the worst of acts." Under said bill, prosecutors would need to prove that home invaders had entered the victim's home with the specific intent to kill them to be eligible for the death penalty. New Hampshire had stricter restrictions regarding when somebody could be sentenced to death, only allowing capital punishment for 6 types of crimes, including the murder of judges, police officers, officers of the court, murder for hire, or first-degree murder while committing a drug deal. If this new bill was passed, it would not be retroactive, meaning that Kimberly's killers could not be sentenced to death. Around 2 weeks later, 20-year-old Autumn Savoy was arrested and charged with helping Stephen and Christopher come up with an alibi, and he had thrown evidence away in the Neshoor River. He told investigators that they had both stayed the night at his home when the murders were being committed. He also helped them search the internet the following day for news reports on the crime. He then helped bag clothing they had worn during the murder and helped them dispose of items stolen from the home. In fact, It had been him who suggested throwing the items into the river. During his arraignment, he told the judge, "I was just scared, as well as I just did what I was told." He was charged with 2 counts of hindering apprehension or prosecution, and 1 count of conspiracy to commit hindering apprehension or prosecution. He was ordered to be held on $100,000 bond. After his arrest, he told investigators where to find some of the items that had been stolen from the Cates home. They found 2 wooded jewellery boxes, sneakers, and a partially submerged wallet, which contained David Cates' military dog tag, as well as clothing that belonged to Christopher and Stephen. The crime scene at the home had really traumatised the responding officers, as well as the first responders. To see a child who had been viciously and brutally attacked with a machete is surely a scene nobody would ever forget. In mid-December, Governor John Lynch, Selectman Tim Finnan, Town Administrator Guy Schaaf, and Police Chief Frederick Douglas paid homage to Police Sergeant Furlong and Officer Eric Wales, the 2 first officers on the scene who had rushed into the home without knowing whether the killers were still inside to save Jamie. While Jamie and her father didn't attend the ceremony, they did meet with the 2 officers earlier and asked for a letter to be read aloud, which read in part, "If you didn't act as quickly as you did, I don't know what would have happened. I thank you very much." Shortly thereafter, the bill that was proposed was denied. The House Rules Committee voted 6-4, noting that the bill would duplicate the Senate measure. The same bill had already been filed in the Senate. Some questioned whether the request was urgent and noted that no other similar law change had been requested since the 2001 murders of Half and Suzanne Santop, who were murdered in their home by 2 men. Deputy House Speaker Linda Foster said that the issue belonged before a special commission studying the death penalty. O'Brien was extremely upset by the decision and stated so. He accused the Democratic Committee of finding Kimberly's death so insignificant that they didn't have time to discuss it. Deputy House Speaker Foster took great offence to this comment, stating, "I find it demeaning that somebody would insinuate life and death is a partisan issue." When you're travelling to a place you don't know the language, it can be challenging to accomplish even the simplest of tasks. I'm a massive traveller, and the language barrier can be quite difficult. In Beijing, for example, I struggled to decipher menus and explain that I was vegetarian. Well, thankfully, there's Babbel, the #1 selling language learning app. Through Babbel's bite-sized lessons, you can learn new language skills that you can actually use in the real world. From greetings, menus, and directions to gaining a deeper understanding of the culture, Babbel really is travel essential. When I downloaded Babbel, I first of all picked a language I somewhat knew already, Spanish. I'd just come back from Spain, and while I knew some basic words, I really wanted to learn more, and Babbel has achieved that. Babbel offers 15-minute lessons, and they are created by over 100 language experts, as opposed to AI. You can choose 14 different languages, and they have speech recognition technology. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to babbel.com and use the promo code Morbidology. That is BABBEL.com and code Morbidology. Babbel, language for life. Support for Morbidology in today's episode is brought to you by Incipio. Founded in 1999, Incipio was born with a love for tech and then the novel idea to protect your phone. Now, 20 years later, they're still innovating and making cases with you in mind. For Morbidology, I genuinely depend on my mobile phone. I use it for Zoom calls as well as researching and making notes on the go. I need to make sure that my phone is protected and charged at any given time. Incipio's Duo for MagSafe case combines minimalistic design with maximum protection. As someone who constantly drops their phone, Incipio's Duo for MagSafe case offers 12 feet of drop protection with integrated MagSafe technology to keep it fully charged and protected from the toughest drops. It's also important to keep yourself protected, especially during these times. Well, their antimicrobial protection eliminates 99.9% of surface bacteria that won't wear or wash off. The phone cases genuinely are amazing, and I cannot recommend them enough. I have four cases in different colours. Incipio's Duo for MagSafe is now available to purchase at your local Verizon or online at verizon.com. Early the following year, police documents would be released to the public, and they revealed that following the arrest, Christopher had made a full confession to the murder. This confession, however, didn't come right away. He first of all denied any involvement, stating, "Assuming someone, somebody specifically, tried to kill them, like that rubs against my conscience personally. It really goes against me to harm a woman in general, but a little girl, how could you do that to someone?" After a while, however, the investigator said to Christopher, "The jig is up, the story is coming unraveled."
"You sit here and you can't be man enough to tell us the truth? My God, what were you thinking? What were you thinking when you were hatching away at her? Hacking away at her? Hearing her scream? Were you smiling?"
Christopher then confessed to the murder and attempted murder. Christopher had told investigators that he'd been wanting to kill somebody for quite some time, and that he felt no emotion following the murder of Kimberly and the attempted murder of Jamie. In fact, he said that his only regret was that he didn't succeed in killing Jamie, because now she would have to live with what happened.
"I guess she was holding to her mom and they were freaking out, and I guess he swung higher and over farther, and the mom was probably sitting up. And the girl was farther down, and so he hit her. Because I heard her go down into the bed."
The documents read in part, Gribble stated that if he realized she was alive, he would have killed her. In the interview, Christopher realized the implications of his confession and became concerned about what was going to happen to him.
"So where are you guys going to take me after this?
Someplace safe."
"Thanks."
Yeah, I do.
"It's not that I don't trust you guys. You seem like you know what you're doing.
No, we do.
But I can't help but be worried that I'm not going to make it throughout however many years of whatever sentence I get."
The police documents would reveal that Christopher had graphically detailed the murders following his arrest. He said that he and Stephen had agreed that they would break into someone's home, and that if anybody was inside the home, they would kill them for fun. They had cut the electricity and then tried to get into the home by opening a basement window and pushing William through it. He was hoping to go upstairs and unlock the front door. However, the upstairs door was unlocked. Stephen then broke into a screen porch and carved the word "die" on the porch before slipping through a hole where the four had pulled out an air conditioning vent. Stephen then opened the front door for the three other men. They maneuvered their way through the home with the light from an iPod they had stolen. They all wore gloves, so did not leave any fingerprints. All four of the invaders made their way to the master bedroom, where Kimberly woke up and attempted to reach for a lamp, asking, "Jamie, is that you?" Stephen and Christopher had stood at each side of the bed where Kimberly had been sleeping with her daughter. Stephen then attacked Kimberly with a machete, while William and Quinn watched from the doorway. By this point, Jamie was awake as well as Kimberly. It was first speculated and hoped that Kimberly had been killed as she slept. The truth, however, was far more horrific. As Kimberly was being stabbed with the machete, Jamie attempted to jump over her to protect her and was stabbed in the face and chest by Christopher, who said that he had tried to aim for her heart. He then threw Jamie against a door and assumed that she was dead. Jamie had told police that she pretended to be dead. Christopher said that he then delivered the final blow to Kimberly by stabbing her in the neck and chest. Stephen then walked over to Jamie, crumpled on the floor, and kicked her in the ribs and hit her in the head with his machete. Following the attack, Christopher said that all four ransacked the home, taking any valuables they came across. They then remove their bloody clothing and wipe the knives with a paper bag from Burger King. The following day, when they found out that Jamie had survived, their friend Autumn had chided them for not killing Jamie. Stephen had said to Christopher, "At least I killed mine." Stephen and Christopher both bragged about what they had done to several friends later that day. One friend, Kyle Fenden, had told his mother, and his mother then reported it to police. Another friend, Elton Spikes, said that Christopher had said it was awesome when he slit the girl's throat, and that Stephen said he wanted to do it again. Elton spoke to a school resource officer. You can learn more about the confession on the Vodacast app. While Christopher was making a full confession to the murder and attempted murder, when Stephen was apprehended, he denied any involvement, stating, "Whoever did it should get the death penalty." He then asked for a lawyer. Following the confession from Christopher, he said to investigators that he and Stephen had been friends for a very long time and described him and Stephen as sociopaths.
Stephen and I are very similar. Stephen Spader. Both of us grew up with problems in our families. Technically, we're both sociopaths, legally, by neuropsychologist's declaration. There should be a paper in the scripture case in the top drawer of my black dresser that says as much.
Okay.
If it's not there, my father knows where it is. He took it to the counseling center that I was to go to today.
Okay.
I do not use that as an excuse. I just thought I'd let you know.
No, that's important facts to know.
Steve and I have been friends for a very long time. I haven't seen him for 2-3 years probably. When we got to an Eagle Scout Court of Honor for our mutual friend RJ Hall. And I saw him and we had a very happy meeting. I rapidly became aware that he was involved with drug dealing, only marijuana, nothing more serious. And that he is a member of the gang of Crips.
Okay.
Quinn had told investigators his version of the night in question. He said that he was driving around Milford and Mount Vernon that night with Christopher, Stephen and William. He claimed that he had an anxiety attack in the car and asked to be left alone on a dirt road in Mount Vernon. According to Quinn, he put on a blindfold and meditated on the road between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. when the three others picked him up and took him home. After claiming this, Quinn then asked for a lawyer. William and Autumn, the person who provided the alibi, changed their initial stories and gave a statement which was very similar to Christopher's version of events. The police documents would also disclose that the four men had committed a number of burglaries in the area before the murder was committed. Christopher and Stephen had burglarized a home near Stephen's home the week before the murder, and then pawned the items that they had stolen. Following the release of the police documents, Stephen, Christopher and William would be indicted on first-degree murder charges. William had originally faced a charge of robbery, burglary and conspiracy, but those were now elevated. His indictment alleged that he had acted with Christopher and William to knowingly cause the death of Kimberly. Quinn agreed to plead guilty to robbery and other charges, while Autumn had agreed to plead guilty to charges of conspiracy and hindering apprehension or prosecution. They both agreed to a plea agreement in which they pleaded guilty and would become star witnesses against the three other defendants in exchange for a more lenient sentence. Their sentencing phase would be postponed until their cooperation agreement was fulfilled during the murder trials. Prosecutors would reveal that Stephen and Christopher had attempted to concoct a homemade batch of chloroform, which they intended using on their burglary victim. Stephen had told people that he was planning on doing this, and when he found a recipe, he shared it with William. Furthermore, Stephen and Christopher were facing an additional charge of witness tampering and threatening. After bragging about the murder to their friend Eldon Spikes, he had told police. The two men then threatened Eldon with a knife, accusing him of being a snitch. In early July, it was announced that Stephen's lawyers wanted his trial moved out of Hillsborough County, because of extensive media coverage. He was going to be the first defendant standing trial, and it was scheduled for October. His defense attorneys, Jonathan Cohen and Andrew Winters, said, "The pretrial publicity surrounding these allegations has been extraordinary in terms of volume, and often highly hostile and conclusory in tone. Stephen would actually send a rambling letter to the Telegraph from behind bars. He said he wanted people to stop presuming he was guilty while awaiting trial, and even referred to people in New Hampshire as brainless, media-driven conformists. He wrote, "Everyone is biased because five 18 to 20-year-old men, non-conforming to society, and viewed as weirdos or criminals or another name, branded onto us because of our appearance or choice in music." Some media outlets had focused on the fact that the defendants were fans of hardcore music, such as the Insane Clown Posse. While it was still being decided whether Stephen's trial would be moved to another county, Christopher's defense lawyers filed notice of a planned insanity defense. Then William's defense lawyers filed an intent for him to plead guilty. However, when William appeared in court, Judge Gillian Abramson said that she would not accept the guilty plea. It was part of a plea agreement in which William would have avoided a potential life sentence. Judge Abramson said that a sentence should be about punishment, rehabilitation, deterrence, and segregating a criminal from the community. She said, "The proposed sentence does not satisfy any of these goals. This court cannot and will not accept the proposed agreement." During the court hearing, William's defense lawyer, Peter Leahy, said that William was sorry for his role in the murder and attempted murder. He said that he had nightmares. His father, James, said that his son had tried everything he could to get out of it. When he was asked why he couldn't, his father, James, said, "I just think he didn't know how." Outside of court, William's father, James, said that he was surprised that the judge didn't accept the plea agreement before stating, "I don't know what the judge knows." According to Senior Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Strelzin, they had enough evidence to prove William's involvement. He said that from behind bars, William had detailed the alleged events of the murder, which had matched with what he had told investigators. In one letter, he said that on the way to the house, Stephen had said that they were about to do the most evil thing the town had ever seen. He had also told investigators that around a week before the murder, he had driven to Truro Road with Stephen and picked the house next door to the Kate's house to break into. However, they later changed their mind because they thought that house was too big. He had also told investigators that he was present when Stephen and Christopher were talking about killing whoever was inside the home and present when they discussed making chloroform. He said that the prosecution also had cell phone records from all five defendants, which showed that Stephen had reached out to them to discuss the plan of murder. They all knew why they were going to the Kate's home that night, and just because they didn't physically participate in the murder and attempted murder, they were all still guilty, if even of a lesser charge. Shortly after the plea was denied, prosecutors dropped the first-degree murder charge against William over the objection of the judge. This gave the judge no other choice but to accept the plea deal and the sentence, which was ranging from 30 to 60 years for conspiracy. There was still much debate over whether Stephen's trial would be moved, and prosecutors would argue that Stephen's letters to the Telegraph were evidence that the trial should be moved because they were adding to the media coverage that his defense team claimed would prejudice a jury. Ultimately, the judge would deny the request to have the trial moved. In early October, just before the first murder trial began, it was the one-year anniversary to the murder and attempted murder. Kimberly's life would be celebrated, with State Representative Linda Foster stating, "I don't think Mount Vernon will ever recover, but we are a resilient community and we do support each other the best we can." She said to the community that it was important to remember Kimberly instead of remember the horrific crime that took her life. A number of purple and yellow memorial ribbons were handed out to members of the community. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. The jury was seated and the murder trial of Stephen was ready to begin on the 24th of October 2010. During opening statements, prosecutor Peter Hinckley held up a long machete as he described the murders, which he said had been committed by Stephen and his co-defendant, Christopher. He said, "They hacked them, they stabbed them, they cut them apart, and this is what this defendant used to hack that mother and daughter in their bed." He revealed that Kimberly had been slashed and stabbed over 30 times. The blows were with such force that two broke her skull and sunk into her brain. One went through the bone in her arm. Finally, Kimberly's throat was slashed. He stated, "Kim and Jamie's screams didn't stop him. Their cries, their begging, their pleas didn't stop him because he was merciless and he and Gribble were focused on what they intended and planned all along. To break in and kill whoever was inside for fun, for kicks, and ultimately for a few pieces of jewellery." He referred to Stephen as a ruthless killer and said that Kimberly had attempted to use her own body to shield Jamie and died without knowing if her only child was alive or dead. Defence Andrew Winter said during his opening statements that the state had no forensic evidence linking Stephen to the crime and said that three of his co-defendants, who were going to be lead witnesses, had cut deals to lessen their prison sentences. According to the prosecution, both Stephen and Christopher laughed and bragged about what they had done, but according to Defence Winters, anybody who knew Stephen knew that he was always bragging or exaggerating about things that were doubtful or not true. The first witness of the trial would be Police Sergeant Kevin Furlong, who was the first officer to arrive at the scene that morning. He said to the courtroom that he immediately saw Jamie through the window and immediately broke down the door to save her. He said that Jamie was trying to scream, but no sound was coming out.
"I saw a young girl laying on the floor. I observed that she was completely covered in blood from her head to her toe. I observed that she had major injuries and major trauma, to include lacerations to her face, extremities, as well as I observed that part of her foot was missing. I got close to her. I told her that I was a police officer. I was there to help. She then said in a whisper while shaking that she thought her mommy was dead."
He carried her outside where she asked him not to leave her, but he went back into the home armed with a gun and flashlight. Here, he found the lifeless body of Kimberly. She was beyond saving. Jurors would be shown photographs of blood leading from the master bedroom to the kitchen where Jamie was found. They were shown photographs of the telephone Jamie had used to call 911. It was covered in blood. Her heartbreaking 911 call would be played aloud for the jury to hear. Photographs of the master bedroom would also be shown to the jury. They showed a blood-saturated pillow and sheets, as well as numerous bloodstains on the floor. Large blotches of bloodstains could be seen in front of the sliding glass doors where Jamie had been flung after being stabbed. Jurors would also be shown a pawn shop receipt for the jewellery which had been stolen from the Cates home. It was made out to Christopher. Following the photographs and the 911 call, Dr. David Mooney would testify about Jamie's injuries. He said that in his 23 years as a paediatric surgeon, He had never seen such injuries on a child. A portion of her left foot had been cut off. Her lung had been punctured. She had been struck in the face with such force that her jaw had been broken and her skull had been cracked. He said that if she lost consciousness before calling the police, then she would have died from the punctured lung. Dr. Amir Taghinia, a plastic surgeon at Boston Children's Hospital, was one of the surgeons who operated on Jamie following the attack. He said that a sharp, heavy weapon wielded with considerable force would have been used to inflict a number of the wounds that she had sustained, but said that a number of the wounds would have been created with a smaller weapon, such as a paring knife, used in a jabbing, stabbing motion. He told the jury he hoped to reattach a piece of the foot which had been cut off, but said that he wasn't successful. Instead, he used it as a skin graft for the foot. One of the lead witnesses, Quinn Glover, would testify on the third day of the trial. He had been at the crime scene as the murders were taking place. He spoke about Stephen being obsessed with murder and said that he had a number of disturbing plans.
I'm sorry, Mr. Glover. Can you again go over some of the things that the defendant was talking about he wanted to do?
Breaking into houses. And he talked about eating people, roasting people, putting heads on stakes, making scenes for the press. It was...
Did he ever use the term sleeping over?
He did, sir.
And what did you take that to mean, sleeping over people's houses?
Staying over the night with the bodies, making a scene, doing things like eating.
He told the courtroom that Stephen was obsessed with the idea of killing people in the weeks leading up to the murder. He said that he had wanted to break into homes, kill the occupants, stay overnight, roast and eat the victims, and then stage their bodies for the media. He said that at one point he had even talked about putting the heads of his victims on stakes. According to Quinn, immediately after the attacks, Stephen was euphoric and excited. He said, "He seemed like he had gotten off a roller coaster. He came out with the machete covered in blood and hair." He revealed that several hours before the murder, Stephen had sent him a text message telling him that they needed to complete the goals of their brotherhood, the Disciples of Destruction. This brotherhood was something that Stephen had formed and had even designed a logo with the initials DOD. According to the prosecution, the home invasion murder was an initiation into the alleged brotherhood. He took the jury through the events which unfolded inside the Cates home, stating that they had approached the master bedroom armed with weapons that they had brought along. He said that Stephen and Christopher were in the lead, armed with a machete and a knife. He said that when the scream started, he turned around and covered his ears. When Prosecutor Hinckley asked why, he responded, "I walked away because I wanted to walk away from the situation. I didn't take anything that was said prior seriously. That was my mistake." He said that he had heard Kimberly and Jamie begging no, and he knew that they were terrified. He said that he also heard Kimberly shout, "Jamie, run, please don't do it." He said that while he didn't see the murder or attempted murder, he said that he came into the room afterwards and saw Jamie crumpled up on the floor, adding, "I thought for sure that she was dead." According to Quinn, he saw Kimberly on the bed covered in blood. She was somewhat moaning and moving, and he saw Christopher put a knife into the right side of her throat. He turned away, and when he turned back, he said that the knife was on the other side of Kimberly's throat, indicating that Christopher had just slashed her throat. Under cross-examination, Quinn admitted that he had lied to investigators during his first two interviews. He had come up with a number of alibis for himself, including that he was meditating on a country road, and then later claiming that he was home with his father. During trial, he said that he was telling the truth. He was asked if he had attacked either victim, and he responded, "No." He further said that around 12 hours after the attack, Stephen and Christopher showed up at his house, and Stephen said to him, "Quinn, we broke up a family. Isn't that great?" He then said Stephen told him he may become addicted to murder because he liked the high from it so much. While being cross-examined by defense Winters, Quinn conceded that he, like Stephen, had talked about killing people at random and had entered the Cates home armed with a knife, which he had drawn. He said, "Did I have it on to hurt people? Yes. Would I have done it, put in the situation? I don't think so." He said that Stephen had picked the Cates home at random, stating, "like the Zodiac killer, and that if we were random like him, we wouldn't get caught." He spoke about the Brotherhood, the Disciples of Destruction, and said that Stephen had created the group to commit crimes. He said that he was one of the founding members. There was a text message from Stephen to Quinn just hours before the murders, which read, "We're ready. We need the completion of DOD. Go on." Eldon Spikes, another witness, would be called to testify. He said that Stephen had waved a knife at him in the hours after the attack and threatened to kill him if he went to police. He said that Stephen told him that he'd hacked the bitch up with a machete before adding that he had no remorse over what he had done. His testimony would then be followed by Autumn Savoy. He told the jury that Christopher and Stephen had come to his home after the attack and told him about what they had done. He said that Stephen told him the attack was an initiation rite for the Disciples of Destruction. According to Autumn, he saw the machete and a bag of clothing that they had worn during the attack. He said that Stephen was bouncy and jumping between conversations. It appeared as though he had an adrenaline rush and was very excited, adding that he had attacked Jamie with the machete when she was pretending to be dead because he was bored of hacking her mother to death. By this point, they weren't aware that Jamie had survived.
So you said he was bouncy?
Yes.
Could you explain what do you mean by that?
He was very up is the best way I can describe it. Very happy, excited. An adrenaline rush.
And what did he tell you?
That he had killed two people.
And where was Christopher Gribble?
He was also in the driveway.
And is that the only thing he said, or what else did he say?
I do not remember what else he said.
Did Mr. Gribble say anything?
No, he did not.
How was he acting?
Very distant, as withdrawn.
Gribble was?
Yes. We talked about what happened, I guess.
What happened?
They'd went to a house, broken in, murdered two people, robbed the house. And then left and came to my house.
According to Autumn, he had provided the alibi because he felt as though Stephen was almost like his brother. That as well as the fact that Stephen had threatened to kill him if he spoke to police. Stephen had allegedly told Autumn, "I love you like a brother, but if you tell anyone, I'll fucking kill you." He testified that Stephen had bragged to him that he had killed people before the murder that night, including dropping bodies in quarries and participating in drive-by shootings in Lowell, Massachusetts, with members of a street gang. He also said that Stephen told him he was a prospective member of the Crips. Kimberly's husband and Jamie's father, David, would be called to the witness stand by the prosecution. He told the courtroom that he was in Maryland on business when the murders unfolded and said that he used to be out of town on business around 26 times a year, but now, not so much.
Prior to October of 2009, was travel a significant part of your job?
Yes, it was.
How much were you traveling back then?
Between 2004 and 2009, I averaged about 26 trips a year.
Has that changed since October of 2009?
Yes, it has.
Why did you make that change?
Because Jamie needed me there, and I needed to be there with Jamie.
Who is Jamie?
My daughter.
Her name is Jamie Cates.
It is.
Is she your only child?
She is.
How old is Jamie now?
Jamie's 12.
How old was she back in October of 2009?
She was 11.
Who is Jamie's mother?
Kimberly. Kate's.
How long were you and Kim married?
We were married in 98, so about 11 years.
He spoke about the relationship that Kimberly and Jimmy had, as well as their plans for the weekend.
What were they planning to do that weekend while you were away?
They had shopping plans and just hanging out together. They spent an awful lot of time together and, just being a mom and a daughter, you know.
Were Kim and Jamie close?
They were very close. They spent a lot of time together.
What kinds of things would they do while you were away on these trips? You said you were gone about half the time of the year.
Yeah, Jamie was involved in school. Kim was part of that as well as, shopping and just hanging out, go to the movies, go to the mall. Normal mom and daughter things. They were also very involved with karate at the time. That was a big part of Jamie's life, and Kim was going to the karate studio quite often with her.
When you were away, was it unusual for Kim and Jamie to sleep in the same room together?
Not unusual at all.
What room would they typically sleep in together?
In the master bedroom.
That was the room we saw with that sliding glass window.
It was.
He would identify a number of items which are stolen from his family home on the night of the murder. After being shown a jewellery box, he said, "That's Kim's jewellery box. Jamie got that for Mother's Day." Assistant Attorney Streslin asked if he had given Stephen or anybody else permission to be in his home that night. He responded, "I did not." Following the arrest of the men, Stephen's computer would be analysed, and Detective Chris Currier would testify that somebody had searched the internet for chloroform several times on the 3rd of October 2009, and for news about a murder in Mount Vernon on the 4th of October 2009. He said that keyword searches of his hard drive found the word knives 635 times, torture 85 times, Charles Manson 6,225 times, murder 1,450 times, and homicide 94 times. A sweatshirt owned by Stephen would be entered as evidence. The sweatshirt had been found in a river where witnesses said the men disposed of clothing they wore during the murder and some items they had stolen, including David's wallet. The sweatshirt in question had Stephen's full name on it. It had been found in a garbage bag with two socks and a towel with Christopher's name on it, as well as socks with Christopher's name on them. Floating alongside the garbage bag was David's wallet, which included his identification cards. It had been Autumn who led investigators to the items. Some of the clothing showed obvious discoloration and stains, but it couldn't be determined if it was blood. Timothy Jackson, a criminalist at the state lab, would testify about tire tracks that were found on True Road and in Hollis, near the Neshoor River. He identified those tracks as most likely coming from Christopher's Oldsmobile Sierra. Forensic expert Emily Rice testified that no fingerprints of any of the men were found inside the Kate's home, but as mentioned earlier on in this episode, they all wore gloves to prevent their fingerprints transferring. After the testimony regarding the forensic evidence, William Marks was called as a prosecution witness. Much like Quinn, he took the jury through the night in question. He said that he was in the doorway of the bedroom when he saw Stephen use two hands to bring the machete down on the bed, while Kimberly and Jamie were huddled together and repeatedly strike them. He said that at one point he had heard Kimberly state, "It's okay, everything is going to be okay." Even as Kimberly was being attacked, she was trying to console her daughter. He also heard Jamie cry, "Please, you don't have to do this." As the machete struck the mother and daughter, William said it sounded like a baseball bat hitting a mattress. William also said that he saw Jamie get thrown against a wall, and as she lay crumpled on the floor, Stephen hit her in the head with a machete and kicked her. He said that Christopher had told him afterwards that he had slit Jamie's throat. He said that while the power to the house had been cut, he could still see the attacks because of the light from the full moon. Under cross-examination, William admitted that he and his father had spoken about selling his story to a national television network to try and make some money shortly after his arrest. He also said that he had initially lied to investigators in a bid to save himself and his friends. He repeatedly asserted that he did not take part in the physical attacks and that Stephen and Christopher were the only ones to participate.
You were in that room that night, that master bedroom?
Yes.
You did a lot more than you're telling us, didn't you, Billy?
No.
You were lying when you said you didn't.
No.
You were lying when you said you didn't attack Kimberly Cates.
No.
You were lying when you said you didn't attack Jamie Cates.
No.
He would identify a number of items which are stolen from his family home. When asked by Prosecutor Streslin if he had tried to stop the attack, he replied, no. The defense would confront William about a poem which had been found inside his cell, which read in part, I always have an axe by my side, looking for my next homicide. It also referred to how he liked to chop up women. Testimony would then be heard from Chad Landry, an inmate who had been in the same cell block as Stephen last winter. He said that he and Stephen passed notes to each other. In one note, Stephen wrote that he hit Kimberly 36 times and could see brains, a lot of blood, and that her eyeball was hanging out of her socket. While this was true, it hadn't been reported in the media at the time, so he clearly knew things about the crime scene that only somebody who was there would know.
I told Gribble to stab her just to be sure. He did. During this time, Quinn and Billy stood at the entrance to the room and watched.
In another note, he wrote, it was such an adrenaline rush. I almost hit Gribble with the machete. He said I looked crazy. The little girl screamed and jumped into Gribble, who stabbed and sliced her head, face, chest, and then threw her into the glass door. I hacked up the mum. The 10-page letter began with, so begins the tale of the Mount Vernon murder by Stephen A. Spader. Chad would admit on the witness stand that he had used the letter to cut a deal with prosecutors to reduce the charges that he had faced. A handwriting expert would testify that the letter had in fact been written by Stephen. Following his testimony, the medical examiner who had conducted Kimberly's autopsy would take to the witness stand to provide some very chilling testimony. She said that Kimberly was alive throughout the entire attack. She had felt every single 32 slash and stab wound that was inflicted on her. They had split her skull open, sliced through bone and pierced organs. Dr. Jenny Duvall said that the injuries had been inflicted by at least two weapons, adding that a machete could have made the long and deep cuts that cleaved bone and split Kimberly's skull open. There were 9 injuries that the machete could not have caused, and others mostly superficial, which could have been caused by a knife or machete. She added that one slash had cut her upper arm bone, and another broke through her jaw, which gave her the impression that Kimberly was trying to defend herself. She said that Kimberly had died from massive blood loss. One of the final witnesses to testify was Richard Gribble, Christopher's father. The pain on his face was evident as he told the courtroom how he searched his home for his machete and his knife after his son was arrested in connection with the murder. He said that he couldn't find either. These were the weapons that, according to prosecutors, had been used during the attack by Christopher and Stephen. Investigators had been led to the machete by Autumn. It had been buried in the woods near Christopher's home. Richard would identify the buried machete as his, as the one that was missing from his home. The defense would call on no witnesses to testify, meaning that when the final prosecution witness testified, it was time for closing arguments. Prosecutor Streslin would tell the jury that the letter written by Stephen was a confession. He said, the defendant is so proud of what he did, he couldn't shut up. These are his words. I hacked at the mum. Death doesn't frighten me. Blood excites me. Page after page of vivid detail only the killer would know about the slaughter of a mother and attempted slaughter of her daughter. He produced a photograph of Kimberly and Jamie and reminded the jury of the medical examiner's testimony, how Kimberly was alive for every single wound that was inflicted on her. He went on to praise Jamie's courage in pretending she was dead and then dragging herself to the kitchen to call for help. he said. She showed more strength in that room that morning than he will ever show in his entire life. Defence Coggan would conjure this, saying that the letter was in keeping with Stephen's reputation of exaggerating and lying. He said, if there is one thing we have learned of this case, it's that Stephen Spader cannot be trusted. The jury would deliberate for just 90 minutes before finding Stephen Spader guilty of the murder of Kimberly Cates, as well as guilty of the attempted murder of Jamie Cates. The first-degree murder conviction came with an automatic life sentence without parole. The verdict had come just a few days before Stephen's birthday, and he was heard saying to his lawyer, "Maybe the jury will sing happy birthday to me." It was just another sign of his depravity and the lack of remorse that he felt for what he had done. Shortly after the sentence was handed down, Christopher would appear in court, where he admitted to the murder of Kimberly, but claimed that he was insane at the time. As the prosecution and defence were preparing for his trial, it would be announced that the trial of Stephen had shocked New Hampshire's governor and House Speaker into supporting the legislation which would make fatal home invasions punishable by death. The bill was named after Kimberly. Many felt moved to back the legislation after finding out exactly what Kimberly and Jamie had endured that night. Christopher's trial would begin in March of 2011. It would follow a very similar format to Stephen's trial, but his defence team would be arguing that he was legally insane. Defence attorney Matthew Hill told jurors that 2 years before the attack, Christopher had been diagnosed as likely a sociopath, adding that he was broken and couldn't be fixed. He said that he expressed no remorse following the murders because Christopher was not like everybody else. Prosecutor Streslin pounced back, bellowing, "He's not like everybody else because he chose to be a murderer, not a madman." He spoke about Christopher's detailed confession, during which he had said, "I'll be perfectly honest, I've wanted to kill someone for a long time." The defence would call on Dr. Grace Talarico to testify. She said that 2 years before the home invasion, Christopher had told her that he often thought about killing his parents, but didn't act on these thoughts because of his faith. Christopher told her that his mother physically and emotionally abused him when he was a child, and that she was struck by his lack of emotion. Christopher had also been to the psychiatrist after being accused of sexually harassing a woman at his church. The psychiatrist said that she had diagnosed Christopher with antisocial personality disorder. According to a friend, Wanda Martins, she had written to Christopher in prison, and he told her he was planning on getting a sentence of 7 to 15 years. She said she didn't know how he planned on getting such a lenient sentence, but said that making up an insanity plea was one thing he could have been thinking about. Other experts would counter the claims that Christopher was legally insane at the time of the attack. Dr. Alan Gladstone, who diagnosed him 2 years before the attack, said he believed that Christopher would lie to avoid a prison sentence, while Dr. Grace Talarico, who testified earlier about her diagnosis, said she didn't believe he was psychotic or insane. Dr. Albert Drutkins agreed, stating that Christopher was not suffering from delusions or an inability to control his behaviour, before adding that he knew the difference between wrong and right. They were a product of his choices, he said, before stating, "He told me that if he wanted to, he could manipulate me to think he did nothing wrong." Christopher would testify during the trial and told the courtroom that he had fantasized about torturing and killing his mother from 14 years old because she had abused him. He said that she used to pin him down and painfully pop acne on his back and pull hairs from his head. He also said that she made him lug a vacuum cleaner around the home when he was barely more than a toddler.
"We've thought about killing your mom, right?"
"Yes, I don't love my mom."
"You hate your mom?"
"Yes."
"Hate's an emotion, right?"
"Yes."
"What you said to your lawyers is you don't kill people you have any emotional attachment to, right?"
"Yes."
"Hate's an emotion, isn't it?"
"There's a difference between emotional attachment and emotion, Mr. Strauss, and I don't think you like me. Do you have an emotional attachment to me?"
"Mr. Gribble, you don't want to know what I think. That's not wrong."
"That's wrong, true."
"Okay. You need to answer my questions. You don't get to ask the questions here. Am My question to you is very simple. Hate is an emotion, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You had hate towards your mom.
Yes, I did.
So that's certainly an emotion directed at your mom.
Directed at my mom, yes.
And you didn't kill your mom?
No.
And you didn't kill your mom because you knew you'd get caught?
Yes.
Christopher's mother would testify and claim she had once spanked him, hard enough with a wooden spoon that it broke, but denied any other past abuse. Christopher then went on to talk to the courtroom about the murder.
He opened the door a little bit and shined it in and looked in, and he said something, which to us, Quinn and Billy seemed to agree with me, that it sounded like he said, "No one's here." And so we were like, "Oh, okay." And so we started talking a little bit louder, like, "Oh, well, this is, you know, all this worry for nothing." And then he turned around and was like, shh, there's somebody there. And he opened the door a little bit wider. I think it was at that point that Mrs. Cates woke up. I couldn't see too well into the room. I generally have reasonable night vision, but I mean, the iPod was right there ruining my vision. I remember seeing like some form sit up on what was to me the left side of the bed.
As you were facing it from the foot?
Yes, as you're facing it from the hallway, it was the left. A female voice said something like, "Jamie, is that you?" At that point, I don't remember thinking anything for a little while. It got really weird. And I'm going to have a little trouble describing it because I've never felt that way before. Steve immediately tossed the iPod and went down on the floor and headed for the right-hand side of the bed. The next thing I knew, I was walking towards the other side of the bed. I don't remember thinking I should go over to the other side. It was just like I knew without having to consider what I should do. I don't remember when I pulled the knife out from the sheath. At some point it was in my hand. I don't remember when I pulled it out. I remember realizing that it was in my hand, but I don't remember pulling it out. And I went to the other side, and by the time I got to that side of the bed, I remember the girl woke up on the right-hand side of the bed. I don't remember exactly what she said. I remember the feeling that she was groggy, but that's all I really remember about it. She might have said something like mommy or something like that. And then Steve just started hacking at the bed. I don't know that he could see what he was doing, but I could tell he was whacking at the bed because I could hear it thumping against the blankets and everything.
He explained that he felt nothing as he attacked Kimberly and Jamie, but afterwards felt a flood of relief. He stated, "I had no connection to those people, so maybe it didn't matter to me." He described plunging the knife into Kimberly's neck, adding that he had to adjust the angle to make sure it severed an artery, and said he remembered seeing Jamie lying in a puddle of blood, with little bloody footprints all around her. Speaking about Stephen bringing the machete down on Jamie's head, he said, "I knew he was trying to cut her head off. He was standing there panting, and it looked like he was in a rage sort of thing. He told the jury that if he were ever released, there was a chance he would kill again." Under cross-examination, Prosecutor Strelzin showed a receipt for the jewellery Christopher had stolen from the Cates home, which showed he sold it for $130.62. He asked, "So that's how much Kim's life was worth to you?" He replied, "That's an interesting way to put it, but yes." Much like his mother, Christopher's father, Richard, would deny that his son had ever been abused. He said that his son often viewed to see other people's views and would twist events to defend his position. He said that Christopher was raised in the Mormon faith, and other than raising their voice on occasion, he had not been abused, either physically or emotionally. He was asked if his efforts to instill good values in his son had been successful. He softly responded, given the fact that he's admitted to committing two very heinous crimes, I'd say no. He said that he and his wife Tamara had always tried to dedicate themselves to their son's activities, and he had gone to Boy Scouts with Christopher, and even Dungeons and Dragons. Some would describe Richard as a patient dad with a very obnoxious teenager. Several people would testify about Christopher's behaviour and demeanour before the murders. His father said that he suffered from centre-of-the-universe syndrome, meaning that he didn't really care about anybody else or see anything from other people's perspective. Autumn would refer to him as a dork, saying that he always wore the same camouflage outfit and was into the military and Dungeons and Dragons. Christopher Gribble didn't really know how to react around people, from my observation, he said. In fact, a number of people referred to Christopher as creepy. Towards the end of the trial, the prosecution would play aloud Christopher's confession to the murder.
And we went in and started looking around. I found the box with all the breakers in it,
mm-hmm.
by the front door, and closed off all the breakers so there wouldn't be any power.
Okay.
We got Billy out of the basement, found out that he was retarded, and brought him up. There were motion detectors around. We weren't sure if we'd set off the alarm or not, mm-hmm. so we tried to be fast.
Yeah.
We looked around. All we found, other than the master bedroom door being closed, was that there was an iPod in one of the girls' rooms, and so we grabbed that.
Yeah.
We went towards the master bedroom, using the iPod as a light. Steve had the machete. I had the Boy Scout knife out. Steven was in the front. I was right behind him. Quinn and Billy were in the rear.
Okay, so all four of you were together?
All four of us were together the entire time. When Steven opened the master bedroom door quietly, he looked in, and he said that there are people, but we thought he said, there's no people.
Mm-hmm.
So he started to get a little bit relaxed and started talking, started to quiet us down. And then he shined the light on the bed, and that's when they woke up.
Okay.
The mother said something like, Jamie, is that you? Stevie threw the light. He went around to one side of the bed where the girl apparently was sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
I started to circle around to the other side in case something happened. And Billy and Quinn stayed by the door.
Okay.
Quinn, I think, it was either Quinn or Billy, said later that they closed the door just in case.
Mm-hmm.
The mom sat up in the bed, started asking who was there, what was going on, tried to turn on the lamp, and it didn't turn on.
Yep.
When she did that, Steve started hacking at the bed with the machete.
Okay.
They started screaming because they heard something. Apparently he missed them mostly. But I heard him hit the mom, and so I dove in and stabbed her a few times in the chest. Okay. Probably two or three.
Yep.
Pretty sure it was three. She started gurgling. Steve was just hacking away. He totally lost it. I was controlled, but I didn't really feel much of anything.
Yep, okay.
I thought I would, but I didn't.
What were Quinn and Billy doing?
They stayed by the door. Okay. They didn't do anything. Honestly, we did everything. The girl jumped up. I almost sensed her in the dark get up and jumped over her mother. As Steve was hacking away, and she jumped right into my arms. I stabbed her once towards the face.
Mm-hmm.
I hit bone. I felt the knife skip off and didn't go in. Then I went for the front. I stabbed her somewhere on the front right chest area. I tried to twist her around so I could get a better shot at her heart. It was automatic.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even think about it. I automatically did it.
Yeah.
I stabbed her a couple times in the back as I was swinging her around, and she got free of my hand and went flying into the glass door, knocked her head, stopped crying completely.
Okay.
I figured she was probably toast.
Yeah.
The mom was still gurgling and kind of breathing deeply. Steve just went at her. I was actually kind of scared of him. He just kept hacking at the bed, came over to our side and hacked at it some more.
Yeah.
And then went over and kicked the girl a couple times with his steel-toe boots, and then hit her in the head with the machete. At least that's so he said he didn't aim for the head.
Yeah.
At one point, he asked about Jamie. He said If you don't mind my asking, what, like, kind of condition is the girl in? Like, is she awake and doing okay, or in a coma, or what? He'd learned by this point that Jamie was a black belt in karate, and questioned, was the girl really honestly a black belt? Just surprising me because she didn't really put up any struggle, before adding, I mean, she was brave to actually jump and run. I mean, I think most kids would probably just blubber there for mom, but she did try to run for the door. It's kind of cool. 11 years old and a black belt? I'm impressed. During closing arguments, Prosecutor Hinckley said that Christopher was cunning and manipulative. He said, in his final comments to the jury, find him sane, hold him responsible, and send this killer to prison. It was now up to the jury to determine Christopher's fate. New Hampshire was the only state with no legal definition of insanity, which meant the question of whether he was legally insane rested with the jury. They would ultimately reject the defense claims of insanity and find Christopher Gribble guilty of the murder of Kimberly Cates and the attempted murder of Jamie Cates. They had deliberated for just 2 hours. Much like his co-defendant, Christopher Gribble was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In handing down the sentence, Judge Abramson said, I believe the record will thoroughly support my belief that infinity is not enough jail time for you. Both David and Jamie were in attendance, and the judge would address them.
Mr. Cates, in closing, I would just like to thank you for the dignified and the graceful tone you set here in this courtroom throughout these proceedings. I don't know how you did it. Day after day, week after week, coming in here and bearing witness to your family's suffering. But I thank you for the way that you did it, and I can assure you that your presence here in this courtroom will resonate for a very long time to come. And I want to thank Jamie for coming here today. It is nice to be able to finally meet you. I think it helps everybody here in this courtroom, Jamie, to finally get to meet you and to see you. You are a lovely little girl, and I hope you know that this man and the other men that were involved in this terrible crime can never hurt you again. I hope you understand that. And I wish you better days. Thank you.
David was allowed to address the court following the sentence.
In this courtroom, I have listened to the accounts of Kim's murder, one excruciating detail after the next, feeling in my body every strike of that machete and every stab of that knife. I can't fathom how depraved a person must be to commit such a heinous murder. Through these accounts, I have heard my wife's last breath. I have listened to my child's screams. I have watched as Jamie's perfect little body was mutilated and tortured. Kim was very strong and a fighter, but I'm sure in the last moments of her life, the thought of her daughter dying next to her was more than she could bear. So she drifted off with the hopes of seeing her on the other side. To the murderer in this courtroom, as I've said in the past, this verdict is not justice. But I can only hope that justice will find you very soon. Your Honor, there is no justice in a case like this, not really. There is only the promise that you make to the rest of us that this worthless coward will never be free to kill another woman as she sleeps vulnerably in her bed, or to brutally attack another innocent child. My wife and my daughter, each weighing less than 100 pounds at the time of this savage attack, were defenseless against the bloody onslaught of these gutless murderers. I don't have any illusions that this invasion to the sanctity of our home will ever be behind us, that Jamie and I will ever be able to go more than a few moments without remembering that Kim isn't with us, or the horrific way in which she was taken from us. There will never be another birthday, anniversary, or Christmas Eve with Kim's family that isn't tinged with grief. Instead of Jamie simply indulging in the joy of picking out her prom dress, or stepping into a graduation gown, or planning her wedding, my daughter will ache because her mom, her best friend, the most important woman in her life, isn't there beside her.
With all of the trials finalized, it was time for the other co-defendants turned witnesses to be sentenced for their roles. Quinn Glover was sentenced to 20 to 40 years in prison. William Marks was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison. Autumn Savoy was sentenced to 5 to 12 years in prison, and in 2015, he was paroled. The Kimberley Kids Law would be signed into law in 2011. This meant that going forward, the state's death penalty would expand to those who commit murder during a home invasion. The following year, a US Supreme Court would restrict the sentencing of minors to life sentences, which meant that both Stephen and Christopher were allowed to have resentencing hearings. Stephen said he did not want a resentencing hearing and referred to himself as the most sick and twisted person you'll ever meet. Through his lawyers, he apologised for the attacks and said that he did not deserve or expect forgiveness. His lawyer said in court that they were preparing to put forward evidence and make arguments as to why Stephen should receive a more lenient sentence, but they'd been instructed by Stephen not to bother. Shortly thereafter, he was sent to prison in New Jersey, where he was attacked by inmates upon his arrival. Christopher would appeal his sentence, but his appeal would be denied. In the wake of the trials, a memorial fund was established in Kimberley's name. It was called the Kimberley Cates Memorial Fund, and since its establishment, it has given out more than $250,000 in scholarships to students who continue her legacy of helping others.
Just like her mother, Jamie approaches each day with passion, hope, and a courageous spirit that has never been broken despite of what she has endured. She continues to trust in the goodness of humanity and believe in the kindness of others. Kim remains a constant subject of conversation between Jamie and me. Whether we're arguing about what's for dinner or hauling a few too many pizza boxes to the dump, Kim is very much a part of our daily routine. And I suspect she'd like Jamie to be eating more vegetables than pizza. Though Jamie and I will continue to move forward, as Kim would have wanted, there will always be an empty place in our lives where Kim used to be. We are both still motivated by the memories we have of Kim, as are so many. She had such an incredible life force that she continues to encourage us to embrace life.
The murder and attempted murder of Kimberley and Jamie Cates sounded like a script from a horror movie. An isolated home and killers who are motivated by nothing other than the thrill of a kill. While we like to think that these acts of pure depravity very rarely happen, the sad reality is that cases of this nature have happened in the past and will no doubt happen again. 12 years have passed since that fateful night, and while Jamie's physical and emotional scars will never heal, she is thriving and enjoying her life. She has grown up into an ambitious and kind young woman, who looks remarkably similar to her mother. While Kimberley is gone, she lives on in her daughter's smile, her voice, and her characteristics. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, a big massive thank you for listening, and an even bigger thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Melissa, Lou, and Megan. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes, or alternatively, you can just search for Morbidology on the free app or website. In return for your support, I send out a handwritten thank you card, as well as some cool merch. That merch includes stickers, t-shirts, pins, badges, and more. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, as well as bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus each month. I also upload bonus content, including case files obtained via Freedom of Information, bonus audio, and sometimes bonus videos. The support really goes such a long way in making Morbidology what it is, and I am eternally grateful. Can I also ask a massive favour and ask that if you enjoy the show, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like, and I love reading your comments. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, They Walk Among America, which is brought to you by the amazing Ben and Rosie from They Walk Among Us. Until next time, please take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
The award-winning team that created They Walk Among Us, featuring true crime cases from the UK, now bring their unique and bone-chilling podcast across the pond to the United States. Dive deep into cases that hit close to the American heartland.
Police have arrested a man they are calling a serial killer.
With the criminals that walk alongside you.
Significant evidence. That's what Maui police are calling the results of a DNA test linked to a 20-year-old cold case murder.
Who live next door, or maybe, who sleep beside you.
Police are investigating a double homicide.
This is They Walk Among America. A new true crime podcast covering tales of murder and mystery in the United States.
The defendant is guilty of manslaughter as charged.
They Walk Among America is a Law and Crime Podcast Network production. For more information, visit lawandcrime.com/podcasts or theywalkamonguspodcast.com.